Steve Gibbons band there and Shopping for Clothes, and before that Alabama 3 playing Monday Don't Mean Anything to Me. What's Monday? Well, it appears for the moment that that Tony the guest has disappeared offline, so there's not a lot really I can do about that. We had a successful talk. I think he's in Thailand at the moment, so perhaps it might be a bit of a bit iffy kind of place to be keeping yourself on the server or what have you. But what I'll do perhaps is have a look at working through some stuff that I was thinking about for later on in the show. I will at the same time try and keep an eye out for Tony, play the odd tune so I can see whether he's around and all of that, because it's quite hard to keep an eye on all of these things and keep one's mind on the subject in hand, as it were. I think that we had a spectacular show last week, I thought, with Rob Freeman talking about the law and talking about how it seems that a different brand of behaviour can result in a completely different brand of results. Basically, Rob's been having a lot of cracking times, I think, out there, and so far has managed to pretty much mirror the world management team's behaviour in such a way as to basically keep himself, shall we say, on the right side of locked doors. One of the things we talked about was the large number of private members' bills that are currently going through the House of Lies, something that was first brought to my attention by Truth Juice Dave, and they are truly inimical to our well-being. And one of the things Rob and I were talking about was just what we as individuals could actually do about it, you know, these things, because there's a lot of paperwork involved in them all. There's possibly the best part of a couple of hundred of them. And as Rob's pointed out, you know, if we don't object, we're kind of consenting. But at the same time, it's not really reasonable to expect every single one of us to object to every single one of the bills. So Rob's busy working on this thing he's calling the People's Mandate, whose intent is to be able to draw individual actions together, basically, and point out that anybody really who has been abused by a system which is roundly abusing every single one of us, the idea is to try and hold them accountable for that, to give them 60 days or so to prove A, that the books balance, and B, that the unalterable rights of people have not been in any way broken in the process of making whatever money is found in the books. And we're pretty sure that neither of those two tasks will prove to be possible. And as he says, if, you know, we had somebody cleaning the house or doing the gardening or whatever it is, and they just were sitting around and playing on the laptop all day and costing us a lot of money rather than doing the work, then we would sack them. And that is basically the idea. So that is, if you like, what they're calling on Critical Mass Radio the power of one, but the power of many ones, effectively, trying to avoid being in a group. And I found myself thinking that there must be things, key things, that we can do as individuals that are going to make a difference to the way things work out. And we've heard over the years on so many places, you know, on TNS and then on MSI, on Scottish Sovereigns on the Land, Scotland is Free, No Borders Radio, Critical Mass Radio, We Roar. We hear now so many strong individuals telling us how their individual behaviour has changed the way things work out for them. And it's partly behaviour and partly words. You know, from Vin and Cooch and Sovereign T, Mr. T on YouTube, Simon Spaniards are putting out loads of interesting stuff. Rob Freeman that we heard from last week, the man who's known as Rob B, another well-informed individual. All of these people are coming up with, you know, their own unique take on what's going on, and their solutions and their methods of dealing are distinctly different from each other, in some cases entirely dissimilar. But for each of the individuals concerned, the methods basically work. Perhaps not for all individuals under all circumstances, but that would perhaps be asking a bit much. And Rob put this down to intent. He says I've heard him say many times, the reason why he's not getting the results that he's getting because he's, unusually clever or unusually observant or bright or what have you, but because it's his intent that's actually washing into the whole system, and meaning that when he goes out to play the system at its own game, he gets a result. I can see that Tony is now on the line, so I'm going to just try and call him up live now, actually, rather than put a tune on. So I'll just see if you'll have to excuse if you hear the Skype things. Log off on the Skype to try and set up a telephone, but hasn't managed to make it back online again. So I think probably what I'll try and do is get in touch with him one quiet afternoon and see if we can't enjoy the relatively uninterrupted Skype contact that we had earlier on. In the meantime, I guess with kind of an hour and a half or so to go, I'll have to see what I can do with the other material that I've prepared in some form or another for tonight's show. I talked a little bit earlier on about Rob Freeman's suggestion of his people's mandate, basically mandating the people who are supposed to be working for us to start working for us and stop working against us, and if they don't, basically to get rid of them. And I've been thinking about the fact that there are things that we as individuals can do to help ensure that what we're making is progress, and that we are in fact going forwards and not backwards, as I think is pretty clear if you look at it askance. It does seem like mayhem, and I must admit that around me at the moment I see a great deal of mayhem in personal relationships and occurrences that are happening to people. Things seem just to be getting faster and faster, and it seems pretty certain that 2014 is going to be a year of unpredicted and unprecedented activity, pretty much the same as 2013 was, but more of it. In the times that I've been listening to TNS, MSI, all the radio stations that I mentioned before, all the people I mentioned before, I suspect have learned an awful lot compared with what we knew, say, even 5 years or 10 years ago. We've learned about money that isn't money, that can only result in debt because it's not money, it is debt in the first place. We've learned that most of the medicines that we're being offered, it would appear, are set out just to keep us alive, keep us surviving with our symptoms rather than sort us out. Some of the medicines actually kill people. We've also found that there are other ones that don't. We've found that we're being maimed, that dependence on all sorts of things is being encouraged. Found out about corporations, the aptly named criminal legal system. We've heard about just so many false flag operations reaching all the way back into history. And all completely surrounded by unmindful behaviour. Lots of responses to all of these things, which are unhelpful to either the individual making the response or in sorting out the general problem. We've got the outrage that passes for television. And one of the things I do tend to think is that I see so much great stuff. I see so many great speakers out live in the field. I hear so many really fabulous radio shows. And just before MSI was taken off the air, I'd been catching up on some podcasts and celebrating the quality of the stuff that was coming out. And it seems clear to me that there is absolutely no need for the television to be doing the job that it's doing, that it could quite easily nowadays be full of really helpful, useful entertainment, which could be waking people up, preparing them and helping them to deal not only with the situation that they find themselves in, but quite possibly with neighbours, with friends, with family. The list of actual challenges obviously goes a long way beyond the television and the legal system. As every single one of you knows, it is a potentially endless stream of stuff. But on the other hand, over these years as well, the number of solutions is also ever expanding. And loads of the solutions are to do with us as individuals, with our responsibility, our ability to deal with the world. I think especially of the stuff I've heard about physical, mental and spiritual health, because it seems to me that our bodies and our minds are the absolute basis of how we interpret what's going on around us and what we might do about it. And I've done 2 or 3 shows and interviews now on the subject of proper hydration. It's absolutely amazing to me that something as simple as water can actually prove to be a major solution to many, many physical ills, as I've outlined it has been for me. Another important part of it, of course, is that your brain's even more water than your body is, something like 80 or a little bit over 80%. And that's one of the places that really suffers when we're not properly hydrated. So if we're going to respond to people with maximum mindfulness and with proper thought and stuff, then hydration is absolutely key to that, as of course is not being poisoned in the first place. Same with nutrition, proper nutrition, something else that's changed in my life. That's maybe a little bit harder thing to pull off, because some of the foods that are best for you are most expensive and very difficult to get in places. However, the less processed food is, and the closer it is to the ground, as it were, by and large, the better it is for you. And as we heard in a podcast a show that Vibe did with Dr. Martin, she was calling him, his full name is slipping my mind at the moment, Dr. William Martin, that's right. He pointed out that sprouting seeds and legumes and the like takes 500 times less energy to consume that food, and it's 500 times better for you. So when I think about simple nutritional solutions to go with the simple hydration, that's one that I'd put up there. Something that's sprouted is just so good for us, and so soft that even me with my manky teeth, I can chew it as well. Along with both of those, of course, comes a mindful balance of exercise and rest, and actually being able to find the time to rest properly and take a bit of exercise, just a bit of a walk. The Dr. Batman said to go with the proper hydration, a couple of walks a day, actually set off your fat-burning systems, which then keep going for 12 hours, which is why he recommends having a couple of walks, because that way the stuff that's burning off, the stuff that you're trying to store, is working all the time. Something else I think that's becoming especially clear too is that social health is also really important, and that means meeting with other people as well as exercising, meeting with other people, conversing, celebrating with others, basically as peaceful, respectful, compassionate individuals, gives us a completely different view of the world and helps make our spiritual and mental systems happier. And once again, the list of solutions we're coming out with is now being extended really daily, which is just as well, really, because these are really challenging times. I find myself constantly amazed at how much more intense experience becomes out in the world and on the internet, really. And it does seem to me, I do have a tendency to believe that every one of us is doing, you know, in his or her own way, what really needs to be done. It's very difficult for us to know what other people should be doing. Sometimes it's hard enough for us to sort out what it is that we need to be doing in the response to any given moment. And all we've really got to go on is a degree of logic and reason and some intuition. There's a bit of me that thinks that the intuition nowadays, things are moving so fast that an intuitive response is what is absolutely necessary in order to be able to work our way through the murk, as it were. So I think everybody is kind of doing the best they can, really, in whatever terms they think of it. And I always appreciated a bit of advice that I got from one of my teachers, I guess, is that even the world management team are doing their job pretty well, because by their every act, by their every deed, effectively, a small spark is being taken to the touch paper of our motivation. I see many people around me having activity encouraged within them as a response to what's going on, and that activity is intensified the more they find out And as this this influence of mine said, she said, as the time comes when these influences are no longer useful, the dark power holders will be drawn back to the heart of the all and nothing manifesting galaxy, where they will be duly rewarded for their sacrifice has been great. To say that anything is unforgivable is to stand in opposition to the benevolent heart of creation from which springs forth all. It was a sentence which, when I first heard it, I found extremely challenging, because that was not the way that I'd been taught to think about the dark power holders or the world management team or whatever we want to call them. But despite all of that, we have to face now the daily challenges of people who are not living peacefully, people who apparently do see many things as unforgivable, people who seem simply to want to make trouble. We've got lots of names for them. We call them shills and infiltrators and trolls. I've met a lot of shills and infiltrators, people who seem to speak some truth most of the time, and are sometimes imperceptibly mischievous, leading us kind of off target slowly and over time. But one of the things that constantly happens is that disquiet is caused. Now, as a result of the loss of MSI and the slow but steady birth of the new People's Internet Radio, I've been trying to keep up a little bit with what's going on in Skype boxes and chat rooms and things. So I've been paying more attention to the internet than usual over the last, 10 days or so. And I must admit, it's always looked pretty civilized to me. I've been fortunate enough in not being on many social networks, apart from the ones necessary to do the work that I'm doing here. I haven't had a lot to do with trolls, but I have seen a lot of trollish behavior recently. And it seems to me that they're a bit different from the shills in that they just seem to be obviously and entirely mischievous all of the time. But again, the basic technique is one of divide and rule, with a few either well-placed or misplaced words, depending on how you want to look at it. It seems to be possible to cause a great deal of disquiet, to cause a breakdown of balance and harmony, and to cause people to split and start arguing and making claims and all the rest of it. And it seems to me that this one world order, if it's going to come, and personally I don't believe it's going to come to that, but it is being built upon, ultimately it's being built upon our separation one from another. So as a basic approach, as individuals rather than as a group, I would think that one of the clearest solutions must be to have the intent of resisting this kind of analysis, this kind of breaking down, and to commit ourselves and our intent to synthesis rather than analysis, to unity, and to a return to sane community in all its forms. This is, I'm sure, what it is that we all yearn for, that we should be living in communities where the weak are supported by the strong, where the disadvantaged are supported by the advantaged, where the minority are supported by the majority. And the opposite of all of that is true at the moment, it seems to me. It seems that a very small minority are being supported by the majority. It seems to me that people are marginalised rather than included. And all of this is happening as a result of the way people think about each other and the way people respond to each other, it seems to me, anyway. And yet it doesn't really matter whether individuals are unaware of the bondage that they're labouring under. It doesn't really matter whether they're aware and resisting taking action for whatever reason, perhaps because they've got too much to lose, or perhaps because hope of success appears to be limited. And it doesn't matter whether they're aware and reassuming responsibility, which is the other option and one which I know many of us are taking. All of those people are effectively dealing with the same challenge. We've become some kind of prey to people who don't care. And sometimes it seems to me that this kind of lack of empathy that we see in the authorities who presume themselves to be, this lack of empathy really for the condition of brothers and sisters everywhere, has to some extent been instilled in the minds of the aware and the unaware alike. I've said before that there's a small number of people who are choosing to, shall we say, occupy the shadow as a effectively a warlike move against the rest of us. But the vast majority of the people who are, I guess, policing the system, upholding it, reporting on it, making sure it works, are people who've kind of accidentally fallen in there, sort of one step at a time, as it were, in the courts, in the judiciary, in the schools, in health and well-being and care, in the army. There must be many people who'd like to see it done differently. And I know when I was talking to Rupert Sheldrake, he was suggesting that he thought that the vast majority of scientists, for example, don't necessarily actually believe the stuff that they're paid to publish or to look into. There are certain ways of getting funding and certain ways of making sure that you don't get any funding. And basically people everywhere have to put bread on the table. So it was Sheldrake's theory that probably over 50% and maybe as many as 70% of scientists have got alternative views that are not being expressed. A, because there's no funding to express those views, and B, because you can kiss goodbye to your career if you try it. I think one of my favourite examples of that is Dean Radin's stupidity hypothesis, which examines the idea that that people who believe in psi, in psychic abilities, in the supramental competencies of the human mind, that people who believe in that sort of thing are undereducated and stupid. That's where the stupidity hypothesis gets its name. But his investigation at the Institute of Noetic Scientists suggests something to the contrary, which we're quite used to, aren't we, when we look closely at things, finding out that the opposite is true. And he concluded that actually, the more education you've got, you know, the however far up you go, whether you go for a sort of MSc and a PhD and all of that, and then research jobs, he found pretty conclusively that that the more educated people are, the more likely they are to believe in psi. And the real telling part of that video is where he says that he talks to professional audiences all the time. At the end of them, he says, you know, if you could do research into these subjects, and if your career was not at risk, and if there was funding available, how many people in the room would like to do it? And nearly every time, he says, most people's hands go up. It is the work that scientists are interested in doing. The only reason there's very few scientists doing it is because it's not where the money is. So as ever, the money is kind of at the root of it. But what it basically means is that there are, in all likelihood, a whole load of people out there who are already, as it were, on the side of light and don't yet know it. It will take only small changes in the behaviour of the people around them to change the behaviour of such people, and I'm sure they will step out of the shadows under which they have fallen. But just like people are accidentally, and now we know, in many cases unwillingly, standing away from the light, I think it seems to be easy accidentally to express a mind which has been conditioned by the dreamlike influences that are around us, by dreams cast upon us not by our own experience, but by, I don't know, the remnants of our culture, by family and friends and peers, and the now all but really omnipresent media. Basically, when we were thinking about the work of Daniel Stone, who will hopefully be on the show in the next few weeks to have a chat with us about this stuff, when we were talking about that, he was quite clear about the fact that our dreams and our thoughts are not simply formed by the development of our DNA and our growing from a single cell into the trillions of cells that we have once we're grown up, but they're formed by many outside influences that we don't necessarily really recognise. Cultural's just one of them, really. There's all manner of other dreams influencing the way our minds work as we grow up. And so it is, I think, that some of the expressions of mind that we find ourselves holding are not our own. And when we look inside and when we consider a peaceful world in which harmony replaces harm, we'll be giving ourselves and others the greatest of gifts. I've experienced this myself in my life. I quite often found myself responding kind of automatically to situations to do with race and soldiery and wars and all manner of things. And I found that the responses I was having didn't really feel natural to me and were not consistent, actually, with the way my mind philosophized the world, as it were. And when I looked at these ideas carefully, it was because they were ideas repeatedly expressed in the place where I was brought up, in my home, in amongst my parents and relatives and the like. There were certain views held by the generation that came before me. I was brought up during the Vietnam War, which made for plenty of differences between what I felt was going on, the ideas of the grown-ups around me. And I realised that I'd kind of inherited response patterns that were automatic. I wasn't actually thinking about them, and they weren't consistent with the way I viewed the world. So that was my first personal experience of this sort of thing, and I'm still noticing it now. There's still aspects of my behaviour which appear to be more or less uncontrolled that come all the way back from all those years ago now, decades ago. And it's domestic habitual behaviour from a place where I haven't lived for 30 years. And there it is, still working away inside me. And still occasionally, when I'm under stress, when I'm tired, when I'm kind of underhydrated and, you know, in whatever disadvantageous state, that is when these behaviours are most likely to manifest themselves. Although it is becoming slightly more mellow as time goes by. And these kind of responses, the ones that are not really consistent with our own thought processes, I think are worthy of examination. In a way, perhaps it's necessary to take a breath in and a breath out before we respond to somebody, to give ourselves time to think about the response that we're giving. Eckhart Tolle, in his book The Power of Now, points out that we all at one stage or another slip into what he calls our pain body. We all of us occasionally find ourselves rubbed up the wrong way, angry, jealous, whatever it is, and responding into the world from that particular position, from one of the many positions that are, you know, all different faces of fear, really. And that there's a tendency amongst us, if we're in close contact with the individual who's upset, then there is a tendency for us to fall into our pain bodies as well and to respond from this position of stress. And I think there's similarities between the kind of anger that can be raised in chat boxes and the various places where we can meet each other on the internet and these processes that I'm trying to describe. I don't know how well I'm doing, but these are difficult ideas to get to. It seems that most of the individuals on Earth now are living in a sociopathic kleptocracy, despised really by the people who are supposed to care for them and being robbed blind. And it seems that consent is given to this enslavement and this being robbed. And the consent's being given in two ways. It's been given, as we know, by language, by simply agreeing, by stating things that are not to our advantage. But we've also learned over the years at TNS and MSI that consent is seeded by performance, by behaviour, by what we do. So by the way we behave and by what we say and when we say it, the spells we cast. And sometimes perhaps we might think that saying what comes to mind in the moment just needs to be said and we can sort of shake it off afterwards. But it seems to me, from watching not only the people around me in especially recent months, but also after the last particularly intense 10 days on the internet, that what we do and say always matters. It's always worth giving it a bit of thought. Again, as I've said before, well, I had a slave job when I was working in industry in a nominally responsible position and wearing my collars, cuffs and tie. One had to work with people. You had to get the stuff out the door. That's what everybody was there for. And that meant quite often working with or for people that it was very, very difficult to get on with. Every large team has them in it, in my experience. And it really wasn't ever wise or helpful to lose one's temper with these people because it never actually got us anywhere. It always did seem to be a good idea to breathe deeply, preferably divorce oneself from the situation for a little bit, think about it, and come back with a considered response. And that always, it seemed to me, that worked better than simply expressing the first thing that comes to mind. Now, if our intent is to be, or to at least cause no harm, loss and damage, and to be peaceful, then if that is our true intent, that is the kind of stuff that we're going to start manifesting around ourselves. And again, in amongst all the mayhem that's going on, that is something that I've seen personally repeatedly happen over the last, I guess, certainly the last 4 or 5 months. I've seen small rifts and small difficulties and small but long-standing disagreements just present themselves for resolution. It's not like I've gone down the thankfully short list of relational challenges that have arisen and decided that I'm going to sort them out. It's that one way or other, each of some, as I say, really quite long-standing issues, is the modern word for them, have presented themselves from consideration and have sorted themselves out. And that's by giving them a little bit of time, by allowing for a little bit of perspective to enter the situation. Sometimes it takes a long time for that to happen. Sometimes it only takes a day or so. Sometimes it can only take a breath, which is really great. And our intent, as Rob Freeman said, is fundamentally responsible for the way our world forms about us. As they say, the form of the things we see is the shape of our consciousness. What else can it be? But perhaps more importantly, I think, intent moulds the world that we encounter. Again, as Daniel Stone said, perception is a creative act. It's not only our response. How we see things is partly being created by our own internal systems, our own ideas, and all of these dreamlike influences that have been upon us. But if our intent is to cause no harm, loss or damage, and to use no mischief in our contracts, to avoid lying and cheating, then these intents will subtly encourage a contact with the world that mirrors these characteristics. And this is something I'm seeing more and more often, which is really great, and just as well, because to a certain extent, whilst I don't think intent entirely takes the place of action, intent is perhaps the most important thing. And it also seems to me that, as sure as a sure thing, part of causing no harm, loss or damage is to try and cultivate compassion and respect for others around us, more or less, no matter who they are. If they're not actually drawing blood or similar, then really kind of consideration for where they're coming from is always helpful. I was given a copy of a book once called Impro, and in it there was an example of, again, what they were imagining was somebody in what Eckhart Tolle calls their pain body, somebody who's in a state, maybe ranting or being otherwise what might nowadays be called antisocial. Now, we do have the choice, obviously, of joining the argument, but what it suggested in Impro was that we could adopt a position where we look at it and we go, well, I don't know why you're doing that, mate. It really, really does look very, very uncomfortable to me. But obviously you're enjoying it, otherwise you'd stop. And the suggestion in the Impro book was at that point to stand back and applaud. Once again, the behaviour is not necessarily affecting us. It's simply what one person is saying and thinking. And in a world of free speech and free thought, hey, why should that really make any difference to me? And really, I would have thought of all the folk around, surely we must appreciate the idea of a world that's not only peaceful and compassionate and respectful, but one in which freedom of thought and speech is assumed and enjoyed. That is, after all, what we are clearly feeling the lack of now. We can see quite clearly in so many ways that if you once again in science, if you say the right thing, you'll keep getting the money. If you say the wrong thing, then you'll lose not only your funding, but you're extremely likely to have your laboratory raided, you'll lose any educational post you've got. Like Johnny Bide says about the fourth law of thermodynamics, don't screw with the other three, else you'll lose your funding. So we know that freedom of thought and speech is not being assumed or enjoyed. It certainly cannot be safely assumed nowadays. Like they said on the old wartime posters, it's more than the walls that have got ears now. And another good reason for wanting freedom of thought and freedom of speech is that each of us presumably has good reasons for believing what we believe and for doing what we do. I know I do. I know I'm quite, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do next, so, or quite understand why I believe what I believe. I'm constantly surprised by the bizarre things that turn out to be wrong. But the reasons we have for believing what we believe, they're quite often, and perhaps almost inevitably, make it very difficult for us to understand, to comprehend the doings and sayings of others. But, as has been said before, if we were to share the circumstances and the education and the parents and the guides and the teachers of this incomprehensible other that we're witnessing, wouldn't we be saying and doing the same thing? Isn't it a kind of denial to believe that with an exactly the same background and all the rest of it, we do anything different from what they're doing? There's a kind of, there is, it seems to me, a sort of judgment and a denial there. And if we're angry and jealous and fearful, we're highly likely, I think, to interpret the behaviour of others in these terms. It's the furniture of our minds kind of reflects the state of those minds and makes what passes for sense of it. But we can't really, if we are, you know, in a state of anger, it's very difficult to imagine other people in a peaceful sense. And actually, that's another thing that I've noticed one or two times recently, is that some of the, one or two of the most peaceful people I have known have been mistaken for being angry people. But they were mistaken for being angry people by angry people. And that's what made me suddenly realise that, you know, even the most peaceful people can, under some circumstances, look angry to an angry individual. And I guess this is what's meant by projection. The the anger in these peaceful people is kind of somehow bouncing back. Difficult for the angry individual who's doing the observing to see a peaceful entity. Difficult to imagine what it's like because it's not where they're coming from. And some people are pretty perpetually angry, it seems to me. And that's why I think that what we're seeing around us, what we're responding to, is in essence a reflection of our own capacities. There is evidently a degree of other energetic interaction, but I still think that fundamentally this projection and reflection thing is basically a sound message. And with regard to people's tendency to do what they're doing for good reason, it's not possible for us to know what others don't know. We often can't even begin to guess. In fact, we can't even really know what we don't know, can we? I can't remember who it was. I remember reading that reason is never understood of its own. It's never understanding of its own hidden assumptions. It can't be. We can't know what we're assuming because we don't know what we don't know. And I've been amazed. I'm frequently amazed at how ignorant I am of really, really simple things that I suddenly realise that everybody else knows. It's funny, they keep popping up on a sort of more or less daily basis. But I've met people, for example, who don't know, in an age that seems to be more or less completely driven by batteries, that there's people out there who don't know how to insert batteries correctly because there's always been somebody else around to do it. And this is one of the ways that it becomes easy not to learn all of the things that we need to know to be a fully functioning individual in what passes for society. There are well-educated and otherwise really well-informed and thoroughly competent and useful individuals who can't with confidence, say, move a laptop from one room to another one and plug it in, not with confidence that it's going to work. And it seems to me that whilst being skilled in many, many things, all of us, one way and the other, all geniuses in our way, whilst being skilled in these many things, and occasionally, under some circumstances, capable of practical, critical and constructive thought on many subjects, I think we are all really fundamentally ignorant of most things. And so what other people are saying and how they're responding to us is an education. How are we going to find out what we know or what we don't know if we're not dealing constructively with the people that that chance or circumstance puts in our way? And if we variously can't comprehend such everyday aspects of life as batteries and where to put a plug and whatever our level and particular area of ignorance is, how much harder is it to grasp concepts like time and the law and the cosmos and all these other amazing ideas that are exploding upon us in so many different ways? How much harder is it to comprehend and internalise, say, something like the holographic structure of reality? Well, we can't understand it in any real detail. There's some that say that you can only really understand it if you can read the equations. Well, I don't think that's really the case, because we are this thing. We are the structure and we are part of the structure. One thing we can understand, because it's come to us through many, many different schools of mysticism, and I'm sure even to us personally, as the veils are getting lifted and we get closer to the nature of the reality that we're living in, we are all becoming aware that whatever we do, whatever we choose to do, we do to the whole system. And we do it to a system of which we are a wholly reflective part. So in a real sense, there is no such thing as altruism. What we do to and for others, we are by definition doing to and for ourselves, and indeed, I guess, for all sentient beings, and for things that pass as non-sentient beings in our particular society as well, because I think there's many people out there who believe that dogs are non-sentient and rocks are non-sentient. Well, I think that all of this stuff has got a soul. All of it knows how to be itself, and everything we do is being done for the benefit of everything else. And I'm pretty sure that that's what, that there's lots of these little sayings in the Bible that are quite interesting. And I think, judge not that ye be not judged, which is interpreted, I've seen it interpreted by priests and the like, and by lay members, to mean that, you know, if you go around judging other people, then when the time comes, you're going to be judged by the big judge. Well, I'm not sure that that's what it's getting at. I think what it's saying is that the disquiet about our reflection that causes us to pass judgment on things that we deem to be non-acceptable or non-forgivable or whatever is us judging ourselves. It's not that you get judged as a consequence of judging others. It's that by judging others, you are judging yourself, because you can't be doing anything else. And that being the case, when and how and what words are spoken or written always matters. We can and we do make differences to what happens around us through each of the words we say and how we say them and to whom. And if in our encounters with agents of the world management team at the roadside or in the surgery or wherever it is that we're encountering them, if it is always our aim to remain peaceful and to endeavour not to alienate the man or woman standing in front of us, which I think is the key aim, that's what seems to be that's what seems to get us into difficulty, is when we can't make that human-to-human, eyeball-to-eyeball, living-heart-to-living-heart contact. I've heard many times that the contact made between the living entities at such moments, or the lack of such contact, can be a key variable in how events unfold. And indeed, now several times, I have myself seen men in uniform approach individuals out on the streets or in their drives, and I've seen these men in uniform approach as officers with their tasers and a stiff bearing and impertinent questions. But through the manner and methods employed by the individuals that they're talking to, I've seen what the guys that turned up as officers, well, guys and gals, in fact, that turned up as officers, I've seen them leave as men and as individuals themselves. And part of this, I'm sure, comes from the intent, the aim, to remain peaceful. Obviously, the most competent amongst us do seem to manage to stay calm and peaceful under all manner of circumstances. But I think that more generally, perhaps, the aim, our aim to be peaceful and constructive is potentially advantageous practice in all of the everyday relationships and interactions that we have as well, where we so often habitually slip into our pain body when the individual that we're most used to dealing with does it. So much habit seems to be a kind of stimulus and response thing. And perhaps some of that would be ameliorated if we could try and take the peaceful and constructive approach that we're imagining for the world management team and use it more generally. In some senses, it seems to me that stuff that was previously chaotic about me, certainly, and to an extent around other people that I know, is sort of becoming coherent. Even it's by definition, whilst things are falling apart, other things are coming together. I think it's another basic principle. But it does seem to me that this business of the previously chaotic becoming coherent and manageable and calm appears to be arising as a result of the way people are treated. Patience and gentleness in the handling of others seems to be critical to getting a good result, just as I found on the odd occasion that it did happen to me when I lost my temper and shouted at people. It very rarely actually got the result that I wanted. Neither did shouting back at somebody that was already shouting, because 9 times out of 10, that's exactly what they wanted, which is the last thing we want to give them. Tolerance is a difficult word for me, because it suggests that there is something to tolerate. But at the same time, having spent a couple of years really on the road living with all manner of people in all manner of places, from fields to domestic houses to, you know, hanging out in the grounds and things like that. It has been necessary to become more aware of what other people are doing and how they live their lives, and to try not to cause disquiet. In fact, exactly the opposite. I nowadays not only don't want to cause harm, loss and damage, but what I'd really like to do is be of benefit to the people and places that I'm visiting. And tolerance is the closest I can come to what you have to do there, because really, people in their own home are living their own lives, and it's only fair when you're there to kind of like try and ease the wheels, really, rather than point out that the wheels are the wrong shape or that they're stuck on the wrong kind of spigot or axle or whatever, because it makes people uncomfortable. And even that kind of level of discomfort can make it difficult to relate constructively and to be response able, as we say. And okay, I think it's probably fair to say that patience, tolerance and gentleness are actually quite difficult to apply all the time. In many circumstances, these are, even now, in effect, a kind of intent rather than an actuality. But as we've heard, the intent in itself counts. And even though the actual long game, if you like, the intended achievement, the aspiration is to patience and gentleness in all circumstances, it does seem to me that I have become more patient and more gentle in most circumstances. And I know that there's people around me who've known me for 20 years or so who would agree. Some of the people who know me for 20 years or so would just say that I've gone completely crazy over the last 2 or 3 years, but I don't think we really need to go into that here. Like I say, it seems to me that the intent to cause no harm, loss and damage in this world is a great thing, where so much harm, loss and damage is being caused. But that's basically a neutral approach. It seems to me that an even better intent is to want to be of benefit, to bring enlightenment and joy and to all of our encounters. In the most difficult of circumstances, all we're going to be able to manage to do maybe is to endeavour to be neutral, or to stay silent when silence presents itself as basically the path of least destruction, disruption. Another pretty successful technique, that one, very surprising to me. Just as the law of intent is described as a universal law, and there was, we did have an interview about that with Claire Montanaro, probably a year and a half or so ago now. Another of my universal law favourites is the law of non-intervention, and that definitely has been one of my most successful lessons in recent years. Many things have resolved themselves in front of my very eyes with absolutely no need for me to stick my oar in at all. And in the old days, I might well have considered sticking my oar in, and it's difficult to say then whether you've made the situation better or worse. Sometimes now it becomes clear that that my intervention is not required and is not likely to be helpful, and that I know kind of in my heart when I've got something useful and constructive to say that might take a situation forward. And sometimes, just like sometimes nowadays I won't intervene, whereas in the old days I would have done, sometimes nowadays if I feel it's odds on that what I'm going to say is going to be helpful rather than upsetting, then I might well throw it in and give it a go, and quite often get paid dividends for that. Sometimes though, even when it seems help might usefully be offered, it can still be beneficial to stay silent and allow the situation to resolve itself. Once again, intent seems to be pretty important there. Certainly the intent not to want the situation to get any worse can be really helpful. And I suspect that once again, that particular intent is one that's accidentally being bred into people by soap operas and televisions and news stories, this sort of prurient desire to watch Formula One racing because you want to see the crashes and things. But an intent that the situation should resolve itself is in itself helpful. So for me, honestly, guys, the phrase "say nothing and keep saying nothing" will be familiar to most of the listeners out there. One that I heard Vin say many times, and that was to do, broadly speaking, with encounters. But whilst recognising that there are without doubt there are circumstances in which staying silent can be the worst of all options, it's a source of constant amazement to me how often such a strategy pays social dividends. Often disharmony just kind of melts away with absolutely no effort, no interference at all, from me or from anybody else. And none of this is to say that that we don't all have difficulties one with another on occasion. Many of you all have heard me talk about life crewing at festivals, coming together with a small team of individuals, put together a quality event, a quality arena, a place where people can be hosted, informed, given tea, food, music, whatever it is. And that these have been some of the most helpful experiences for me, that I really do sort of feel a need for it now to get out of the kind of dog-eat-dog, siren-filled everyday world into an area where people are actually working for each other, and they're doing it calmly, where there's very, very little grief and a lot of things get done, and it really is a different way of living. But even in those circumstances, there are occasionally flare-ups. There are almost bound to be. But there's a difference. It's not like everybody kind of bundles in and takes sides and, you know, it becomes a bit of a team game. What generally seems to happen, and again, it was a bit of an enlightenment for me, what generally seems to be happening is that it's accepted that the people concerned are feel a need to do that and are doing it at the moment. But that basically it's their business and everybody else can kind of continue to go about doing what they're doing without feeling any undue stress from difficulties experienced by two individuals. And that ability to stand back, not get involved, and keep your own mind focused on the job in hand and focused on what it is that you're doing with the people who are being constructive and creative with you, is the most important focus you can have. To allow focus to drift away from that is really helpful to anybody. Just have to excuse me a moment. I do have a brief list of notes here. I'll just kind of, every now and then my mind kind of wanders while I'm doing this sort of thing, and it just did. It just wandered away there. I guess for emphasis, this particular apprehension has been very useful to me. The idea of staying silent, the idea of not intervening, the idea, again, like Dr. Martin Williams said on Vibes thing, he said, basically, if you haven't got anything useful to say, say nothing. That there's no point in engaging in gossip, even if you know the gossip is true. That putting good stuff out there is a lot more helpful always than putting bad stuff out there. And it saves so much effort every now and then to watch and learn from a situation rather than to try and get involved in it when it's only really of peripheral interest, you know. So it's been extremely useful to me, that has. But it's also made it more apparent to me how often it is that people around me are in states of profound disagreement about things that might or might not matter. And it does seem to me that all the relationships we have are potentially open to improvement when we actively consider not only what, when and how to say things, but but also, and perhaps even especially, that we consider when things need to be said. Perhaps that should be when things need to be said. When things need to be said and when things need to be said. Because I think perhaps we're encouraged by the media, I'm not sure what it is. I think certainly from things like Facebook and Twitter, there seems to be a drive to comment on absolutely everything. I certainly quite often feel like phoning up Jeremy Vine's Radio 2 show when they've got these bizarre conversations on, which I occasionally catch whilst I'm round and about the place, and nearly always they're talking about something that I could definitely phone up and give them a 10 penneth, but I don't suppose if I told them what I wanted to talk about, they'd actually let me on anyway. So that's another kind of example of restraint, really. And despite the fact I never hear any views like the views that we express, guys, I never hear any of that really on those shows. That doesn't frustrate me or make me angry either. I'm just sort of inert on the subjects, really. But it's kind of good because it fires up the mind, gives you some idea of which particular bit of the program's running and how it's running. So our intent to do no harm and to bring enlightenment and joy to all our encounters changes how the world manifests. And even modern physics is one with many mystical teachers in suggesting that as each of us chooses what we do, so the world becomes. And of course, ideally, and I stress ideally because I can see it's not always the case, I feel that ideally our behaviour and the spells that we're casting with every word we say, ideally, these spells should be consonant with the intent to do no harm. And of course, every word that is uttered or written is revelatory of our intent, of our inner state in the moment that we're saying it. And peace is a really important idea. I was talking with Synchro the other day about peace poles that have been erected around the world. They've been put up in the name of peace. And as far as I can gather, the early peace poles said on them, they said, inner peace leads to world peace. Which is, of course, one of the fundamental messages here, is that when we're witnessing a lack of peace in the world outside us, then it is a reflection, that's all. And that, this again, I think is a very challenging statement to the many, many people who seem to believe that the responsibility for peace somehow lies outside the self. Always reminds me of Darren Diogi's definition of freedom, which is something along the lines of, freedom is when your own internal state is unaffected by the opinions or state of others. Inner peace leads to world peace. So that's a kind of extension of the same thing. We are free when we're thinking what we're thinking and doing what we're doing, and the thoughts and sayings and doings of others don't really affect us. Inner peace leads to world peace. What an absolutely great and fantastically challenging statement to put on poles that you're putting up around the world. I do gather, it seems sad, but it also seems true, that many of the peace polls around the world now read, may peace on earth prevail, which is a completely different thing, is it not? For a start off, it doesn't show you where the actual peace starts, which is with inner peace, but it's one of those sentences that just doesn't seem to do the job at all. Only peace on earth, not peace generally, for a start off, and prevail is a word which suggests that there is some sort of contest, which there isn't. There is only inner peace. Two phrases not the same at all. And we are primarily, it seems to me, at war with ourselves, and that it's not going to be by arguing and shouting at other people that we sort that kind of inner challenge out. It's really only through the synthesis of light and shadow within ourselves that our intent is going to become real. It's our own personal transformation that we have the opportunity to achieve here. And the transformation of others is a whole other story, really. It's a related story, without a doubt. But it's really not our problem. It's really not. It's our own behaviour. Transformation of our own behaviour is what will transform the world around us. And who knows, perhaps transform the behaviour of others as well. Like the man said, it's pretty important to remember every time we open our mouth that the light at the end of the tunnel may be you. I used to, one of the things, again, that I found really useful is meditation. And I have every now and then tried practicing specific meditations. I do nowadays find that the single point meditation or just meditation on the breath is for me pretty much the most advantageous, works pretty well. But one of the ones that I tried for a long time, because I wasn't feeling compassionate about people, I was feeling angry, I was feeling well cheesed off and quite often abused. And I was at the time working with a bunch of people called, I think they were called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, and they taught me a thing called the Metta Bhavana meditation, which is a meditation on compassion. I can't remember exactly how it worked. It had a little mantra with it, but basically the idea was to start developing compassion for as many people as possible. And they suggested that the training taught us to, first of all, concentrate on the mother. An interesting subject, which again we don't have time to go into right now, but the mother and the family and loved ones were the first ones for whom compassion was kind of encouraged, and it was hoped that by thinking of people that you knew and loved, that the feeling of compassion would be more or less second nature, that it'd be much easier to act. There we go. Oh, I spotted that. I've very nearly almost lost the stream there. God, blimey, it's really difficult. It's really difficult to concentrate. Where was I? What was I saying? Yes, it was hoped that by imagining compassion for friends and loved ones, that compassion would be fairly easy to imagine, because those are people for whom we naturally feel compassion. They're the people we know best. They are doing things that at least we're familiar with, even if we can't really understand them. And I guess it's a reasonable enough assumption. I found it quite difficult myself even to do the compassion thing that close to home. It was a hard practice for me, this one. But the basic idea is, having done a bit of time with the family and loved ones, and for the first time as you do the meditation, I think that's where you stay. You know, you don't bother doing the more complicated bits until you've got some kind of handle on that. But then the idea is to move outwards, as it were, and start developing compassion for acquaintances. I don't know, for guys you see down the newsagent, perhaps, or, you know, people you only come across occasionally. Maybe for the people at work as well, actually, the people with whom one is forced to work and for whom one feels absolutely no compassion at all. So that's the next stage. You move from your family and your mother out to acquaintances, and it's hoped that your experience of compassion and your feeling for it will be expanded and rendered deeper and more generalised as a result. And then obviously eventually you end up trying to do the same practice, but this time for people who you might regard as your enemies. I don't really regard myself as having any enemies anymore. It's been one or two people that there's been disagreements with, like I say, but all of those seem to be kind of resolving themselves, which is absolutely great. But nonetheless, I suppose you could kind of, aim that kind of compassion at people like George Bush, one of the dark power holders who definitely did his job very, very well indeed. That's the idea. Let's say instead of enemies, then start developing compassion for those whose presence is contraindicated. So the meditation begins with those we love and those who are physically close to us. Then it moves focus to the more remote friend or acquaintance. By this means, basically, the practice is perfected until we feel compassion for those who are imagined to have given rise to animosity, enmity, jealousy, or any of what are basically all multiple manifestations of fear. And that seemed to me to be a really great practice, but it was practicing compassion in theory. Practicing compassion in the head. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. We're told that Einstein got a lot of his ideas from mind experiments, not from stealing them from the patent office, of course. But mind experiments, given that everything seems to spring from the mind, it's as good a place to start as any. And like I say, I came across it years ago and I found it a very useful practice. It did actually certainly change the way I approach people in a small way. But the work I've been doing for the last couple of years, trying to do the radio shows, like I say, being out at festivals, working with different crews all the time, and especially staying with people in their domiciles whilst helping out, it's become apparent to me that this particular practice is a lot more useful when it's practiced, where possible, in the world as well as in the meditation room. I'm just going to put on a quick tune. It's 11:30. I just need to gather my thoughts a little bit more, perhaps have a look at the chat box, see if there's anybody in there listening. So I'm just going to play a couple of tunes. I feel like playing some quite light tunes. That one will do really nicely. This is a very nice tune indeed. This is Smile from Heal the Last Stand. Reckon I'll be back with you in about 5 minutes or so. I should have gathered my thoughts together.
I wonder about you when I'm walking through the park. You're everywhere I go, and I wonder who you are. I smile at you sometimes, and you even notice me. And if I'm paying attention, I get a chance to see that being good to people is as simple as a smile. That hopeful little moment when you catch somebody's eye, they can tell and you can see that somewhere deep inside, we're all in this together. I hope you enjoy the ride. There's so many people in this world that I forget to stop and say hello. It's no wonder we ever met. Next time when I see you, I won't miss the chance again, 'cause I see no reason why we should not be friends. Being good to people is as simple as a smile. That hopeful little moment when you catch somebody's eye, they can tell and you can see that somewhere deep inside, we're all in this together. I hope you enjoy the ride. Family somewhere. I wonder where you're going and if I'll know anyone who's there. If we're somehow connected on the outside as within, can we not forget our differences and let the love begin? Being good to people is as simple as a smile. That hopeful little moment when you catch somebody's eye, you can see that somewhere deep inside, we're all in this together. I hope you enjoy the ride. Being good to people is as simple as a smile. I hope a little moment when you catch somebody's eye, they can tell and you can see that somewhere deep inside, we're all in this together. I hope you enjoy the ride.
So as the as the I Ching says, as again, frequent listeners will know, one of my favourite bits. I've got many favourite bits in the I Ching, but this one is a great one. It says, if a man sitting alone in his room can change the world, should we not then be cautious? And if we choose to imagine that supposed man alone in his room, but connected to the internet, perhaps this is an especially perspicacious piece of law. If a man sitting alone in his room can change the world, should we not then be cautious? And we know, don't we, that we can and do change the world simply by being what we are. And would we not change the world so much the better by becoming, through practice, that which we aspire to be? The very practice in and of itself could surely only lead to a better world. In fact, it seems this is true even of the committed intent to practice. But what if with practice and in the knowledge that we can and do change the world just by being here, what if we can become consciously creative in our responses? Perhaps we might eventually become peaceful and respectful and compassionate always. And I guess what I'd really like to see coming out of all the mayhem that's going on at the moment is a sudden and utterly unexpected outbreak of civil rest. That's what I'd like to see. And the business of developing compassion and developing a sense of equanimity towards the agents of the world management team, if we want to do that, how much more useful would it be if we started to develop a compassionate and peaceful approach to those around us, you know, to our friends and our family, our acquaintances, and to all of the people with whom we end up exchanging word and co-responding. An alertness and a respect and a compassion for the attitudes of others. If we wish to be peaceful and beneficial in our encounters with those unwitting agents, what better place to start practicing than with our informed peers? If respect and compassion and open hearts are difficult to manage amongst ourselves, are we able to communicate the message of no harm to a living soul to the denizens of the shadow? It seems to me to be unlikely. Also, waiting to practice until we encounter the agents of the world management team can quite often itself lead to a bit of difficulty. We really do need the practice in equanimity. And I've been quite shocked by especially some of the things that I've seen in the chat boxes and stuff, amazed at how people seem to want to undermine all manner of good things. And I guess this is a kind of appeal that when we're co-creating this vision that we're all living in, and we know we are co-creating it, do we not, that we need to be alert to the thoughts and feelings of ideas of others involved, because it's that alertness that makes us different. It makes us different from the psychopaths, you know. The alertness to the thoughts and feelings and ideas of others and how we respond is what makes us different from the psychopaths ultimately. It's a bit of a hard-edged difference, but I'm sure it's basically right. It is the difference between those who don't want to cause harm, loss and damage, and those who are willfully and consistently mischievous. So it's an appeal to consider what we're saying to others and to be compassionate and respectful, because everybody is worthy of compassion and respect. To say that people are not worthy of compassion and respect is, as was said earlier, to stand in opposition to the heart of all creation from which everything we witness ultimately kind of springs. And I'm going to finish. This is something that just came synchronicitously earlier today. Synchro was reading to me out of a book, and she was reading to me about a dream. This is from a book called The Change of Time. Chura, The Change of Time, also by Daniel Stone, who I shall say again will be on the show very shortly. We had a show discussing some of his work, but he's going to come on and talk to us about the work he's been doing in the Centre for Conscious Dreaming out in Mexico. And this is quite an amazing little book, but this is a dream that he had. It's not very long. But it struck me as really resonant because it's very difficult. I think it's very difficult to deal even-handedly with some of these ideas, just like it's difficult to deal even-handedly with people sometimes. But in terms of energy, in terms of feel, I think this dream very much kind of says better than I have managed so far to say what I want to say, or at least to come out with the correct implications. I heard on the mainstream radio the other day, I heard that John Cleese was asked by Neil Innes to do some poetry. They've done lots and lots of other things. He wanted John Cleese to write him some poetry, and then he was going to put some music to it, and they were going to have a musical. And John Cleese said that he had a difficult relationship with poetry because he felt that if you've got something to say, then you should just come out and say it, which is a fair enough comment, isn't it? But I still think that there are some things that it's extremely difficult to say directly. I think there are some things which are better said with a poetic or an imaginative turn of phrase, because they are poetic and imaginative ideas. And I think this dream is one of those things. And he kicks off by saying, "I found myself on a boat. There were many people. It felt like the ark. We were going towards the future. There were various captains. They fueled the boat with their song. Some sung the boat some sung the boat fast, and some sung the boat slow. We were going towards the future. We didn't know where that was, but we could see a yellow light. We were sailing into a yellow light. When the captain sang slowly, I felt I could see more clearly where we had come from and where we were going. The boat was made of wood, and the trees were still breathing through it. The trees were guiding us along the timelines. When the captain sang fast, I felt sick. I couldn't understand the transition through time. It was just a jumble of powerful images bombarding my body without any sense of meaning. Still, my energetic body craved meaning. We were going into the future, that was for sure. We had left the Earth behind, and the only connection we had with the planet now was the trees breathing the boat and the captains singing the song. We were carrying the dream of Earth, but already it had passed, and we didn't know what connected this world with the next. Only the song knew, and the singers knew nothing of the song until it was sung. I tried to extend my mind into the yellow light of the future so that I could see where I was going, but it was like the song which was sung too fast. The singer was speeding ahead without the body. The body wasn't ready. The body of the boat had its own timing, and it was this timing, I could see, that would make the right pace of the song so that everyone would understand and everyone could see very clearly where we were all going. The trees breathed the body of the boat, and when the song sung in the rhythm of this breath, everyone was content and forgot their anxiety. But when the singer forgot the pace of the trees, everyone felt sick and tried to escape. There was no escaping. We had all made up our minds to travel out of the time circles which repeated our lives. We had all made that leap of faith, and all of us would have to learn to sing, and all of us would have to learn to be captains. When it was my turn to sing, I opened my mouth and a song came out that wasn't mine or didn't seem like mine. It seemed to come from somewhere else. The song sung like more than one voice. It was like a community of voices singing. It was a very comforting song. The voices of this tribe seemed to be calming us down, telling us that we would all be fine, that we were not alone, even so far away from the planet on which we were born. We were being called home into the next dream. It was a patient song, a song that knew love and healing, like the mother rocking the baby, like an old man who has walked through so many of these lives, reassuring us with his wisdom that we were on the right path, we had made the right choice. What choice had we made? For me, there didn't seem to be any options. Once I realised that time would only repeat me into the same circles, I knew I had to find freedom. I guess that's why everyone on the boat had come, to find freedom. When the other people sang, I realised they also were not singing. None of us were singing. We opened our mouths and we were sung. Not all of the songs were easy. Some songs were of pain, of loss and of grief. Some songs of complaint. One song complained of paying too much money to get on the boat. This made us all laugh because money was of no use on the boat, and we gave all we had to build. We were all committed to the journey into freedom, and this had cost us nothing less than our lives. We are all committed to the journey into freedom, and this had cost us nothing less than our lives. Well, I really like that. What we seemed to be doing on the boat was to bridge the gap between present and the future. We were like scouts dreaming ourselves into the future to establish the new dream, to journey into the future dream that had already been dreamt. For us, we were prisoners into uncharted, into uncharted territory. But these timelines had long formed the dreams into which we were travelling. The future was known, and yet we did not know it. Technically, it should have been easy, but none of us had much of a clue. Well, I think it's a fair description of the situation. As far as I can see, that's a fair description of the situation we find ourselves in. And I think patience, compassion, respect in communication, and the intent to do that is seriously going to make a difference to the world. We're out here on the raggedy edge together, and the last thing we want to be doing is running the divide and rule between ourselves. Things have obviously become a lot more peaceful over the last few days. I'd just like to appeal to everybody to approach people with an open heart and realise that whatever it is they're saying to you is being said because there's something to be learnt. And also, if there wasn't something to be learnt, then we would simply ignore what the other person was saying. We wouldn't look up for the paper or whip our iPod out of our ears or whatever it is. If it wasn't important to us, we wouldn't notice it. Because we're noticing some things and getting excited by them, that means, I think, that there are things to learn. So the first hour and a half of the show was very, very rocky. Bit unfortunate that we couldn't get Tony on the line. We got a fair few extra tunes thrown in as a result. Sorry, it was all a little bit incoherent. I'm going to play some more tunes and find out who's coming up next on, if I remember rightly, I think Cancel the Cabal with Super Big Bad Man will be on at 1 o'clock, although my memory is not all that it used to be, and it probably never was, truth be told. So in finishing off the talky bit, I'd like to bear in mind that we're asking for the manifestation of what we're seeking is the making real to the touch of things that we already have. I came across a long time ago now, maybe 25 years, I don't approve of all prayers and did wonder about the nature of prayer for some time, but this is one that I liked when I first read it and I like it now. So I'd like to thank all of you for being there. I'd like to thank People's Internet Radio for keeping this thing going and for scotlandisfree.ning.com for kind of hosting it. It should always be remembered that an enormous amount of work goes together to put in every single radio show that you hear on here out. But at the moment, there is also a huge amount of work going into building and maintaining an infrastructure that will enable us to carry it further forward. So thanks, and thanks again to all those myriad people that are hiving away in the background there, keeping a schedule together, trying to deal with all of the various difficulties we have hosting people, getting it together, getting it online. And I'm absolutely certain, I shall just check, I'm absolutely certain that there is a, well, I haven't seen it. I bet there is a donate button somewhere, the donate button somewhere on Scotland is Free. And I would imagine that one of the things that's dried up along with a lot of other things is funding. So if anybody's got any money and can donate, I'm sure we'd be very grateful. It's going to be necessary to keep the whole thing running. In the meantime, I will be back with you next week, hopefully with a live guest, one that I could actually keep a Skype link going to, or perhaps one that's physically present with me. I've got plenty of guests that are lined up. It's just that everything's really a bit edgy at the moment, and it's quite difficult to keep enough of a handle on it to get a show on the road every week. But hopefully it'll be getting a little bit more coherent as time goes by. Hell, it hasn't happened so far. It's bound to happen eventually. In the meantime, Tar to you, like I say, for being there. Here's that little prayer, and then there'll be a bit more tunage. And the prayer says, and remember what Rob said last week, or on one of his shows, he said the basic idea with intent is to imagine that you've already got the stuff that you're seeking, that when you ask for it, you imply that you have a lack. So, you know, if you're asked for cash or something, it's best to feel the feel of it in your fingers, feel that you've already got it, feel gratitude rather than a need. And that's what really works. So let's just feel the gratitude for this which we already have. Let us welcome the manifestation of the unlimited lightness of being. Telepathic union, one harmonious planet. May we align as a collective earth force and live as the agents of bliss and magic we know ourselves to be.